Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. We do more varieties and flavors of cheese than anywhere else on Earth. By pushing the boundaries of what cheese can and should be, find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer. My guest today is the fabulous Maren McKenna. She's been on the show for, I don't know, it must be almost 10 years. You've been coming onto the show to talk about a variety of topics that are of great interest to me, especially antibiotic resistance. But Maren McKenna, for those of you who have not listened to her on this show in the past, she is a journalist and an author specializing in public health, global health, and food policy. She is a senior fellow of the Center for the Study of Human Health at Emory University, where she teaches health and science writing and storytelling and media literacy. Her books are Big Chicken, The Incredible Story of How Antibiotics Created Modern Agriculture and Changed the Way the World Eats, Superbug, The Fatal Menace of MRSA, and Beating Back the Devil on the Front Lines with the Disease Detectives of the Epidemic Intelligence Service. That was your first book, wasn't it, Maren? That was like 2003 or four?
I think it was 2004. And yes, and thank you for mentioning all three of them.
Yeah, of course. And you were like 12 when you wrote that, right?
Something like that.
Because you'd be amazed that the girl looks like she's no older than, I don't know, 35, maybe. Not that it matters, but still, it's like kind of amazing how much you've accomplished. Maren is a senior writer for Wired. So if you don't follow her at Wired, people, do so now, because it's always a good time. And her articles have appeared as well in the New York Times Magazine, The New Republic, The Atlantic, National Geographic. Well, I could go on for another paragraph, but I will spare you. You can go to her website and look up all the cool things that she has done in the course of her distinguished career. Maren, thank you so much for joining us today to talk about the avian flu, another subject near and dear to both of our hearts.
Thanks for having me back.
You're very welcome. So what prompted me to contact you was a February, I think, 17th piece in Wired about avian influenza, the current outbreak, and the longer-term implications of this virus. So just for starters, can you remind listeners, how does avian flu work? It's not as obvious as it might seem.
So the first thing I want to say is thank you for reading my stories. And the second is that it happens that on the day that we're speaking, right, I just published an update in Wired about the latest news with regard to avian flu. So what we're going to be talking about today, or what I'm going to talk to you about today, are not just the things that I published in February, but also some new news that's been published just now in the first few days of March.
I'm excited. I can't wait to hear about it.
Avian flu. There is this virus, influenza. We're all familiar with it because if we don't get our flu shots, we are vulnerable to getting flu. And flu can be a really terrible disease. People get a little sniffle and they think, oh, I've got the flu. In fact, they probably just have a cold. If you have the flu, you'll know it because you'll feel like you were run over by a large truck.
Yes.
And periodically, and no one is really sure how often this happens because we don't have good enough records to really be predictive, but every couple of decades, let's say, that winter infection of flu in humans boils up into a pandemic. Mm. And before the coronavirus came along, flu was considered to be the most likely candidate for a pandemic among humans, looking back to 1918,
right,
which I think still is the worst health disaster ever, but COVID is creeping up on it. So everyone thought a novel strain of flu would spread rapidly around the world and kill lots and lots and lots of people. Now, The reason that that's important, even though we're here to talk about birds, is that flus, many strains of flus, affect many different species. Mm. But it happens that flus that affect us can be traced back to flus that affect birds. Wild waterfowl are the natural host of some flu strains. And for people who are old like me, they might remember that a novel flu strain jumped from birds into humans in Hong Kong in 1997. Mm-hmm. And it sickened 18 people. It killed six of them. So that's a mortality rate of one-third. That's pretty high.
Yeah.
And the only reason that that outbreak was stopped was that the then territory of Hong Kong killed every chicken in the territory, which was about 1.4 million chickens. And that stopped H5N1 avian flu from spreading further in humans and causing very serious disease. Now, it didn't stop it forever because in about 2003, H5N1, which is not really a single strain, but more like a category of strains, arose again in North Vietnam and began spreading around the world. And periodically since then, it has been both infecting birds and also jumping into humans. And to this point, and we're now more than 20 years out, about 850 people have been known to be infected with H5N1 avian flu spread from a bird, and a little more than half of them have died. So again, small numbers, high mortality rate, something that would be very concerning if it kept going, not just from bird to human, but from human to human to human.
So that's, and that's the big scare, right? That's what people are worried about.
And that's why a lot of people care about flu, is that sort of monster under the bed in the background that someday a pandemic might arise. But people in agriculture, or people like you and me who care about the food supply, know that there's another effect of these strains moving around the world. And that is that they have become increasingly severe in their impact, both on wild birds, which didn't used to happen, and also on domesticated birds, various kinds of chickens, turkeys, ducks.
Right.
And here in the US, since January a year ago, a highly pathogenic, very dangerous, fast-moving, extremely illness-making form of H5N1 avian flu has been spreading across the country and just decimating poultry flocks.
Right.
And also species of wild birds. The ornithologists that I spoke to for the story that published this morning are incredibly concerned about the impact on wild bird populations, which is something that is much harder to measure than if you have an entire house of chickens that are confined and you can see that they're all taken out by the flu. People are starting to talk about a second silent spring. That's how severe the species loss is.
Wow. Because typically, let's go back for a second. Typically, a wild bird is immune to the virus. In other words, they carry it. They shed it through their feces or respiratory secretions, but they themselves don't normally get sick. But in this case, they have been getting sick and they have been dying, the wild bird population.
That's a good way to say it in a short form. There's a whole bunch of complicated influenza virology behind that about when flu is low pathogenic and when it's high pathogenic. And wild waterfowl usually carried the low pathogenic form and basically pooped it out all over the world as they were migrating. And now it seems that the high pathogenic form is actually is infecting birds and taking them out.
Incredible. And of course, there's going to be another mass migration as birds move from the southern to the northern hemisphere again, which may further, have further implications both on the industry, but also on the wild population, right?
Right. And we are, of course, in the beginning of the migratory season right now, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And There's some interesting biology behind that as well. I was talking to a wildlife biologist the other day who said, you know, when birds are on the move in the spring, they tend to move pretty fast because the desire to breed has a great deal of control over their behavior.
Right. But when they're migrating, how unusual.
But when they're migrating in the fall, they kind of are more leisurely about it. And they might stop more places. And when they stop, if they stop on a pond, and if that pond is on a farm, it's more likely that they are going to pass that flu strain that they are carrying on to local wildlife or local poultry. So for anything that we see in the spring with regard to bird flu being passed among birds, there is some concern that the fall is always going to be a larger wave. And things are pretty bad now.
Wow. Scary. So let's just to give people a sense of what we're talking about here. Do you have numbers on how many birds have been, you know, either infected and or culled? I mean, it's because, as we all know, the egg prices have basically doubled. And that is largely because egg-laying birds seem to be particularly susceptible. So what kind of numbers are we talking about here, given the size of our industry?
So the World Organization for Animal Health, which is a UN agency comparable to the World Health Organization for humans, estimated recently that in this most recent wave, more than 140 million poultry worldwide either have died from the virus or have been slaughtered to keep it from spreading.
Right. Wow. 140 million.
In the United States, and this is, again, in a span of about 13, 14 months, we're talking something like 60 million.
Yeah.
Broilers, broiler breeders, laying hens, turkeys, domesticated ducks, either killed or slaughtered.
Well, to put it in perspective, our poultry population for broilers is like 9 billion, right? With a B.
That's right. And so it's there's a way in which you can look at these numbers and say, well, you know, if the denominator is 9 billion and that's just meat chickens, that doesn't take in turkeys, ducks, and laying hens, then maybe this is not so bad. But on the other hand, it is a ferocious amount of both animal suffering and also food waste. And we've seen, this winter, we've seen the impact of that in supermarkets because prices at the end of, in December 2022, egg prices were more than 200% higher than the year before. And that's because last year, avian flu and steps to control it took out almost a third of the laying hens in the United States.
Wow. Now, just to digress for a second, is the reason that laying hens are particularly susceptible to this because of their genetic makeup? Because, of course, they're bred, you know, their genetics have been monkeyed with so that they produce, you know, many more eggs than any normal laying bird ever did before. Or is it because they are housed in such great concentration? Or is it because they live longer than a meat bird, which typically only has a lifespan of about 6 weeks?
So these are all really great questions. And they're
they're
things that the industry is actually talking about right now, because you're right. In this past year in the United States, the greatest impact of this current avian flu, the technical term is panzootic, which is a pandemic that happens among animals, was on laying hens and on turkeys. So there's a couple of nuances here. The first is that every type of poultry, broadly defined, that we grow in the United States is grown under different conditions. So people have probably seen pictures of the barns which are called houses in the industry that broilers are raised in, which are, you know, football field length, solid walled metal sheds with big fans either in the sidewall or at one end. So there's no outdoor access unless they are free range. I'm not talking here about free range or organic birds.
Right.
Turkeys, on the other hand. Oh, and that house can, a typical broiler house might hold maybe 30,000 birds.
That's right.
Turkeys in the United States are not raised in solid walled barns. They are raised in what are called curtain barns, which is something like a half wall with sealed mesh curtains that come down from the roof. And there are smaller numbers of turkeys. It's not tens of thousands, but it might be thousands in a turkey mm-hmm. house. Laying hens, on the other hand, their houses are enormous. And on a laying hen property, a large laying hen property such as exists in Iowa, there can be millions of birds on a single property. Now, that might be a couple of houses. It's not necessarily that 5 million birds are going to be in a single building, but they are there right. in incredible concentrations. So that's one thing. So you can imagine that with those different styles of houses and those different concentrations of birds, both the demands on biosecurity, on keeping, doing the things that keep a virus out of your property or out of your barns, are going to be different depending on whether a sparrow can get in or whether Right. there are 1,000 birds versus 1,000,000 birds. So that's one thing.
Yep.
The second thing is that kind of inherent in that the design of the industry in which different species or different varieties of birds are housed in and grown in different ways is that, as you said, they also live for different amounts of time. Now, the classic broiler that we all eat, the meat chicken, is mostly slaughtered by 42 days old, right? So they're not around very long to be infected with something. Just the probability, it certainly exists there, but they're just not going to be around that long. Turkeys take about 6 months to get to market weight. Again, these are sort of, I'm talking here about kind of standard commodity
your butter
varieties,
ball. Right?
Not heritage birds, not the kind of birds that are grown organic or free range. Those literally can be different varieties of poultry with different metabolic demands and different appearance and so forth. Now, laying hens, whether it's a hen that's laying eggs for market or a hen that's laying the eggs that are going to become the broilers, those are called broiler breeders. You can't really get a hen to lay an egg before it's about 26 weeks old. And then their laying life is 30 to 50 weeks. So we're talking about a bird that lives a year and a half.
Right.
And it happens that over the past year, turkeys on the one hand and laying hens on the other hand, which both live longer than broilers, seem to have been hit the hardest. Now, this may be artifactual, because on the one hand, layers are in barns in those enormous concentrations. So once a virus gets in, it can really get going.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, turkeys are kind of well known in the industry for not having very robust immune systems. And so it may be that they are uniquely vulnerable in addition to being grown in barns that are possibly more difficult to make fully biosecure. Mm-hmm. But So bubbling under this vast concern about the advance of bird flu is the question of, are the ways that this very large industry has historically grown all these animals that represent protein, do those still work? Or do they have to change things in various ways? And there is a segment of critics of the industry, and I wrote about this about a month ago, who are saying, look, we know you've tried your best, but you ought to be able to see by now that biosecurity is just not going to work for you anymore, that you cannot make your properties secure enough against a virus to protect your birds unless you make them so sealed that you start to bump up against animal welfare. Now, even in the broiler industry, animal welfare has been getting better. There are certain companies like Purdue that actually have been working on things like reducing the amount of antibiotics that they give their birds and giving the birds natural light and giving them enrichment so they can exercise and things like that. But, you know, if the way to keep a bird safe is to grow it in as sealed and sterile a situation as possible, you can see how that would militate against, like, giving them some bales of hay to jump on or making sure that they've got more fresh air. So there's a lot of conflicts in a lot of competing factors that are making this very difficult to tackle.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it can't just be, it really does make you, well, anyway, we'll go on, but it absolutely does beg the question of, you know, breaking up this system into at least smaller units so that you don't have to slaughter, you know, 500,000 birds at a go because you're, you know, housing them in barns where there are 20 or 50,000 at a time. So I don't know. I'm not an expert, but, you know, that just seems like a basic concept there. But boy, what is it called? What kind of costs are we talking about here? What kind of economic losses? Just to put that into the mix of why we maybe need to switch up the way we grow poultry in this country. But do you have any figures, Marin, about like what is a contract farmer who loses his, you know, entire, okay, say you pointed out before the show that an egg laying bird is not that system is not the same as the contract growers that I talk about a lot on this show who grow meat birds. So laying birds are typically owned by the big company. Say it's Calmaine, I think, is the biggest egg producer in the country. So what kind of losses are they sustaining when they have to cull, you know, 68 million birds?
So we're still in the midst of this current wave. But but we can start to estimate what the impact is going to be by looking back at the last wave that was significant, and that was in 2015, right, when avian flu, again, H5N1, landed mostly in the Midwest and mostly affected turkey farmers. And I went to some turkey farms that had been depopulated at the time that belonged to West Liberty Foods, which is a farmer-owned cooperative in Western Iowa. Mm-hmm. And when you count the value of birds lost and the on infected properties, and then the value of birds lost in the sort of like bullseye rings around those, because USDA planning for epizootics calls for slaughtering out a certain distance. Ooh. And then on top of that, all the sort of tertiary losses to farm economies in small towns, because we're talking about, you know, if you've depopulated your farm, then you don't need feed delivered, and you don't need repairmen coming, and your household income is probably less. So we're talking in the billions of dollars. There was a report by the USDA after action about a year after that outbreak concluded, and I don't have the numbers in front of me, but it was definitely in the billions.
Wow.
It is important to say that there is a government indemnification program. You know, the way that we handle avian flu in the United States right now, when it blows up big like this, is that farmers are indemnified by the government. So the government comes along, arranges for their flocks to be slaughtered, and then they get paid back. Now, farmers will tell you that first, the money comes late, and second, the money isn't enough. And that, of course, makes some people tempted to maybe not be as forthcoming as they ought to be when they feel like the virus is headed in their direction. Because you can just imagine how terrifying this is.
Sure.
So I have not yet seen any estimates of what this wave is going to cost us, but this is already worse than 2015. This current wave of avian flu just in the United States is the worst animal disease outbreak in the United States in our history.
Wow. Well, on that note, we'll take a short break for a sponsor drop. We'll be right back with Marin McKenna to talk more about avian flu and its implications for both our food supply and our future as humans. Stay tuned.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Wisconsin, the state of cheese, makes half of the nation's specialty cheese and wins more awards than any other state or country. Our heritage and traditions, master cheesemaker program, and the American propensity for innovation all put Wisconsin on the cutting wedge of cheesemaking. With over 600 varieties of cheese to choose from and 5,500 national and international awards and counting, get ready to turn your refrigerator into a trophy case. Enjoying a Wisconsin cheese is basically like winning a gold medal in culinary achievement. Set your mind at cheese. When you bite into a wedge of Wisconsin Wonderful, you know it is made with the ultimate skill and passion possible. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
So, Maren, this is our worst avian flu outbreak. It outdoes our last one. Was that the one in 2015? Was that also H1N5? Am I saying that right? H1N5?
It's H5N1.
H5N1. Thank you. I knew I was doing that wrong. I'm looking at it and saying it
wrong. Flu is kind of an alphabet soup. And, you know, there are many flu strains. There are many types of flu. The strains are within the types. The key thing to know, and it's just sort of a bit of flu trivia, but it might help people understand, is that the H stands for hemagglutinin, the N stands for neuraminidase, and what those are proteins on the surface of the virus that do particular things. One allows the virus to penetrate a cell and then reproduce, and the other allows the new daughter viruses to break free of the cell that it's just hijacked. Mm-hmm. But because those are on the outside of the virus and they control how the virus interacts with what its host is going to be, those H's and N's are used for typing. So there are something like 16 H's and 9 N's. I might have that backwards. It might be the other way around. Anyway, there are lots and lots of flus. But
right.
H5N1, that broad category within which there are many clades of flus, has been the bad actor ever since 1997. Though what we are dealing with now is not the exact same virus as in 1997, because flu is unbelievably restless and promiscuous, and it just mutates nonstop, which is why humans have to get flu shots every year, is because the flu that comes around every year has changed a bit. And that's also true for avian flu. And that's important because there's a lot of debate in the veterinary world and the protein world about, should we be responding in a different way? And the U.S. government started to support, after 2015, some explorations of whether it would be possible to vaccinate birds against flu. And there are some candidate vaccines stockpiled from 2016. But because flu is so restlessly mutating, there's no guarantee that those vaccines from 2015, 2016 would still work today. That's a subset of the enormous discussion about whether to vaccinate birds at all, which you might want to talk about.
Well, I do want to talk. I mean, I'm desperate to talk about that because, of course, we talked about before the show, there was a long piece in the Times yesterday about the government mulling this over. And interestingly, it is not straightforward as one might imagine. I mean, of course, if you support vaccination programs in general, which I do, you know, you would think, well, of course, it's a no-brainer. I mean, yes, there's, you know, 9 billion broilers in this world. That's a lot of vaccines. It'll take you a while to get through all of those birds. I'm not quite sure how that would even be accomplished. There are surprisingly loud voices of dissent, including the Natural Poultry Producers Council, which is very anti-vaccination, for reasons of trade. And I wondered if you could talk for a second about that aspect of why a vaccine program might not be the best road to take.
So in defense of my own employer, I have to say that we have a story about bird flu vaccination this morning, March 8th, when I am talking to you.
Yes.
So on the surface, you would think that vaccination against bird flu in birds would be uncomplicated because, after all, as we talked about a moment ago, humans take flu shots. We're supposed to take them every year. We have an industry devoted to reformulating those and distributing them. And also, poultry get vaccinated against other diseases, either in the egg or in their first few days of life. So it's not as though vaccinating poultry per se is a thing that people object to. But here's the problem. People might understand this by remembering some of the early disputes we had about the COVID vaccines when they came in I guess it was 2021, that there's a difference between a vaccine preventing you from becoming infected, from acquiring a virus, and being able to pass it on to someone else, and a vaccine that keeps you from getting sick. So you might actually be infected, but you don't actually develop symptoms. And that is a question that haunts the poultry industry.
Oh.
Because to this point, the way that you would vaccinate birds against avian flu is literally by giving them a shot. In fact, it might need to be two shots. And so if you imagine that you are faced with a barn of 35,000 three-week-old broilers, what if you miss one or two?
Yeah.
Or what if they have an incomplete response? Or what if they actually were vaccinated and they become infected and they don't show symptoms, so you don't know that they're infected, but they can still pass the virus on? Because of this possibility that vaccination might not be 100% and it might be possible either to keep allowing transmission or to hide within a vaccinated flock birds that are not vaccinated, all around the world, the big poultry producing companies have been extremely reluctant to accept vaccinated birds in trade. And we have enormous broiler trade in the United States. It's billions of dollars. Now, there are countries that are bigger than us. Brazil also doesn't vaccinate. China does. China has been vaccinating its poultry for a couple of years.
Really?
But it's a question of who is going to allow vaccinated birds across their borders? Who is going to take them in trade? And at the moment, no one is willing to be the first country that steps forward. And in fact, I will say that no one in the poultry industry will talk about this on the record at the moment, but academic experts who are adjacent to the poultry industry are saying, look, they're all talking about this because no one can see any other exit strategy right now because there is so much virus in the world. There's not only so much virus in poultry, but there's so much more background virus because so many more wild populations are affected now than have been in the past that there's no way to get away from it, no matter how biosecure you make your properties. So what it would have to take to start vaccinating poultry is basically for everyone to agree. And that's starting with the World Organization for Animal Health and coming down to national governments and then coming down to production organizations, however they're constituted in various countries. So in the United States, that would be the National Chicken Council, whom you mentioned, and the U.S. Poultry and Egg Association. I've forgotten the formal name for the turkey producers, but there are production organizations that stretch across those industries. So everyone would have to agree within a country and everyone would have to agree in those countries' trading partners. We're talking about something that has the scale, if not the formality, of an international treaty. Everyone's got to say yes, and at this point, most people are saying no. There are only a few countries that routinely vaccinate, and that's China and Egypt and a few others, but for the most part, they are places that do not have huge foreign trade.
Wow, fascinating. I mean, it's just, you know, there's never any simple answer to any problem, is there, especially when it comes to agriculture. Can we talk, I don't want to take away from the work that you just published today, and since I haven't read it yet, I'll ask you to lead on that. But one of the things that was in your piece, the first piece that I read in February, is that this particular H5N1 strain has in fact jumped from birds to mammals. And that's why, you know, people like you and the scientific community and the industry itself are all sort of hitting the panic button. Can you talk a little bit about that, you know, sort of without raising a pan? I mean, we don't have to worry that it's going to be a pandemic in the human population just yet. But as we've been discussing, viruses evolve. So what are we looking at here with that, you know, with that in mind? And how is the CDC preparing for that?
So I talked a couple of minutes ago about how flu is this just enormous thing, right? And there are flus that affect many different species. And many of those individual flu strains are uniquely adapted to their species. So they make a certain species sick, but they don't make another species sick. They make a bird sick, but not a mammal sick. You know, they make a dolphin sick, but not a pig sick. But there are certain types of flu that seem to be better at crossing the species barrier. And those are flus that affect birds and flus that affect pigs. And that has to do with the biology of the birds and the biology of the pigs and the biology of us that make us all vulnerable to each other's flu strains. Right. And in that catastrophic first outbreak of avian flu H5N1 in Hong Kong in 1997, that was the first time that that particular strain had jumped from birds to humans. That's why it looked alarming. Mm-hmm. But what is most worrisome is not that a flu strain just jumps the species barrier like, you know, a bowling ball accidentally popping into the next lane.
Right.
It's that the bowling ball keeps going across all the lanes. That would be a hell of a throw. So if a flu strain not just jumps, but then adapts in its restless mutation to its new host, whatever that new species is, and becomes more efficient at affecting that new host, and then being able to be passed on to other members of that new species, that's when things start to get worrisome. So here we have a fundamentally avian flu that, to this point, has jumped into humans 850 plus times, killed about half of them. But almost all of those infections have been just bird to human, and then it stopped. It was sort of a dead end. The flu did not evolve enough within that person to gain the ability to infect another human being and to keep going and keep going and keep going. That would be the signal that something really nasty, like the beginning of a pandemic, might be starting.
Yeah.
But in between birds and us are other mammals.
Sure.
And so this category of flu, H5N1, this strain effectively, but it has clades within it, has been infecting more and more mammals. And not just like a single mammal, but large amounts of mammals. So the big, the very worrisome signals in the past couple of months have been that in January, on the coast of Peru, more than 600 sea lions were found dead of H5N1.
Oh my!
Flu. So that it is unlikely that, I mean, it's possible, but it's unlikely that migrating birds individually infected every single sea lion in that colony. What is more likely is that the flu got into them and then evolved enough for them to infect each other. Similarly, H5N1, last fall, but this was just made public last month, invaded a farm where minks were being grown for fur in Spain.
Right.
Now, that might ring a bell to people because mink farms were also a problem in COVID. It turned out that SARS-CoV-2 was particularly good at infecting minks. And so both farmed minks and then spreading into wild minks, like really worrisome that SARS-CoV-2 is very good at finding alternate hosts. But to return to flu, H5N1 flu got into this mink farm. It was unclear whether the mink were only being infected by birds nearby or whether they were infecting each other. As a result, the entire farm was slaughtered, about 52,000 minks.
Yeah.
Now, what's going on in there as well is not just a mammal being infected by avian flu, but it's also a mammal that's being held in confinement, kind of analogous to the way that poultry are being held in confinement.
Right.
But the sea lions were free living. I mean, they were just like flopping out on the beach and catching fish and doing the things that sea lions do in 600.
But they love to snuggle up. I mean, I watch there's a seal colony right off the shore of where I live, and they snuggle up, man. Those guys are all piled together when they're taking a rest on the rocks.
Yeah.
So I can easily see how they would be able to pass it from one to another.
So to be very anthropomorphic, and to give the virus like agency and intention, which it doesn't really have, but it's sometimes hard not to anthropomorphize these things. You can kind of think of avian flu as like a burglar who wants to get into your house. and it's going around your house and testing every door and testing every window and checking the air ducts and, you know, whether any of the like flashing from your dryer is loose. Any vulnerability to get in. And these infections in poultry, in wild birds, in mammals, and some recent infections in humans are, there was a girl who died in Ecuador a couple of months ago, and a girl who died in Cambodia just a couple of weeks ago.
Right.
These all represent the flu virus, the H5N1 strain, kind of tapping at the door of our world.
You are scaring me, girl.
Just rattling the doorknobs and checking the window locks. And, you know, someday one of those is going to give way.
Are you feeling from your research, let me ask you this, and then we're going to have to wrap it up here. But there was one question I had for you, which I know the flu is a virus, but I was wondering if your research between sort of antibiotic resistance, the development of superbugs, and our widespread use of antibiotics, both in the human and in animal populations, are these also contributing to the abilities of these pathogens to evolve in ways that outwit, you know, our best efforts at vaccination and so forth?
Well, flu doesn't become resistant to
antibiotic.
Vaccines.
But
in
does
the way
it have an
bacteria.
Impact on the immune system that would allow sort of better penetration by a virus?
It's an interesting question that goes way beyond my knowledge, but I will say this, that there are people in the part of, you know, who are concerned with antibiotic resistance, which, just to remind listeners, it only affects bacteria, right? So bacteria and viruses
are
different things.
It's not a virus thing, right.
Antibiotics only work against bacteria. If you have a viral infection, do not take antibiotics. It will not work.
Right.
You may think that you feel better. That's either placebo effect or maybe sort of a little sort of general kind of inflammation reducing effect, but antibiotics will not make your flu better. Please do not take them.
Right.
But there are people who've been working on sort of the meta picture of antibiotic use and antibiotic resistance for a long time, mm-hmm. who keep pointing back to the fact that we cannot separate ourselves from the microbial world, that right. anything we do with regard to deploying antibiotics affects the microbial world that we live in animals, in our bodies, in the environment. And as we've come to understand, we are ourselves microbial worlds, right? We have
right.
microbiomes. And when we take antibiotics, we affect those. Now, we affect them in some obvious ways, like if you take certain antibiotics for, you know, a respiratory infection or something like that, you might end up with diarrhea for a couple of days. That's because the antibiotic nuked your gut microbiome for a few days.
Right.
But increasingly, as we deploy antibiotics, we're doing things not only within our bodies, but also on our bodies and to our environment in a way that is just changing the competence, the microbial competence of the world to deal with threats. Does that have an impact on how flu can affect populations? Is there something going on in the microbiomes of poultry that are affected by, that are vulnerable to flu? I don't think anybody has done that research. It's an interesting speculation, but we are way beyond my knowledge at this point.
Right, right. No, I mean, I understand it's speculation, but it's just something to think about because, I mean, your work has been so important when it comes to raising the red flags about excessive use of antibiotics. And, you know, the more we have learned about the impact on the microbiome, as you point out, you know, the more it makes me wonder, it's like, it's sort of the, I don't know, what is the analogy I'm looking for? It's the, you know, we're killing the goose that lays the golden egg. I don't know. But, we're sort of like, as we deplete the effectiveness of our antibiotics, we're also at the same time making ourselves, I think, so much more vulnerable to so much greater range of possibilities for infection. It just sort of makes sense to me that even though a virus and a bacteria are obviously a very different organism, if you sort of reduce your overall ability to withstand those infections through these superbugs that are being created, as well as our sort of general depletion of our own defenses, it just makes sense to me that, you know, we become more and more vulnerable even to a virus, despite the lack of connection to antibiotic use. And Maren, is there anything else you wanted to say about the article you published today, since we didn't really get to review that thoroughly?
So the one thing that I would say is that, and thanks for asking, is
sure.
that I really think that the discussion over whether poultry have to be vaccinated is going to heat up now because, mm-hmm. as somebody in the industry said to me, there is no other exit strategy.
Yeah.
And that is not a quick or calm discussion to be having. It's going to require some really fundamental examination of the underpinnings of the poultry industry. But there's also a really interesting thing that happened almost 20 years ago. There were two back-to-back avian flu outbreaks in Italy that were very, very destructive to poultry. Mm-hmm. And in Italy, they were caused by wild birds, by a particular migratory pattern that pooped out flu on poultry in Italy. Mm-hmm. And a very clever virologist there figured out a strategy to attach to vaccination that basically solved the problem that lies at the heart of the trade barriers, which is how do you tell if birds are silently infected or if they are vaccinated? Because if you vaccinate birds and then you go back and test them for surveillance to see if they've had an immune response in the bird, the immune response to infection and the immune response to vaccination are going to look like the same thing. They're going to have antibodies against flu either way. What this virologist figured out is that you can tweak the vaccine. You can actually switch the N in the H and N. This was not an H5N1 strain that was affecting Italy back 20 years ago. It was an H, they were H7s, H7N3 and H7N1, I think.
Okay.
They switched the N. They tinkered with the vaccine strain in the lab before they concocted the vaccine. And then they administered the vaccine to chickens. And then when they went back and tested the chickens to see if they had an immune response, that switched out N showed up in the antibodies that the birds had. So it was like a marker saying, oh, look, these birds are vaccinated. They would be safe to sell. They are not silently infected. They are not going to carry infection into trade networks.
Right.
This strategy is called DIVA, which stands for differentiating infected and vaccinated. And
I like it.
So it kind of, after the outbreaks were over in Italy, things kind of went quiescent on this idea because the huge expansion of H5N1 didn't really start until 2003.
Uh-huh.
And when it started in countries like Vietnam that didn't have a lot of infrastructure or a lot of national funding that would create the kind of scientific backdrop that you'd need to make something like this work.
Right.
So this concept has just kind of languished.
I see.
All of a sudden, people are starting to talk about it again. Now, it would require a lot of spinning up of particular sort of scientific infrastructure to do this, but it might be the sort of backdoor that allows vaccination to be instituted in the poultry industries. And that would allow vaccination to happen. It would keep trade networks open. And most importantly, from my point of view, if vaccination can be brought in, it will eliminate an enormous, just incalculable amount of animal suffering. Because avian flu is a horrible disease in birds, in poultry and in wild birds. And the things that they do to poultry to kill them, to keep avian flu from spreading,
that's not great either.
Awful.
I mean, pretty rugged. Yeah.
The American veterinary community is at war within itself right now over some of these culling methods. Because
yes,
you have
I've
to kill them
that.
Quickly. Otherwise, the flu is going to just keep boiling up. But killing animals quickly and killing them humanely, those two things are hard to balance. And so if we could get vaccination in, we'd save the protein, we'd save the trade networks, we'd save the farm economies that are, that surround all of this poultry growing, and we'd prevent animal suffering as well.
Right. And let's also have the benefit that it will prevent the virus from continuing to mutate so that it then becomes, adept at getting into our house.
Right? Absolutely correct.
Yeah. Well, we have to leave it there, Maren, but thank you so much. What an interesting discussion. I'm sorry we don't have more time for this. Let people know where they can learn more about your work and read your latest articles.
So I thank you for that. So people can always find me at marinmckenna.com. But at Wired, I actually have my own author page. And let me see what the exact, you can just Google me, I think. But I'm like wired.com/author/Marin McKenna. And all of my stories are there. And as I look at it, there's an awful lot of bird flu stories on that right
now.
Yeah,
so check it out, people, because it's something we all need to be paying attention to. This is major stuff for us. This is the food supply. So, you know, it behooves us all to be, it's not something that's happening far away in Wisconsin. You know what I mean? It's like, this is right in our grocery stores, right on our plates. So worth talking about, worth thinking about. Thank you so, so much today, Marin. I really appreciate your time. And I hope we'll be speaking again soon. I'll be keeping an eye on your page. And we'll keep talking about the avian flu. So well, thanks to my sponsors, as always, and to my listeners for tuning in. I appreciate your support each and every week, and we'll see you next time. So long for now. What Doesn't Kill You? Food Industry Insights is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.